I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. Three Al Jazeera English journalists convicted in Egypt of aiding the Muslim Brotherhood were sentenced to prison, two receiving seven-year terms and the third journalist a 10-year sentence. 90.7's Carmel Dalshad spent time in Egypt covering the Arab Spring. She joins me to talk about a ruling that shocked journalists and activists worldwide. Also talk about the changing landscape of journalism in Egypt. Also, emergency management officials are always looking for ways to improve disaster relief and response through technology. I'll revisit a conversation with University of Central Florida Professor Pamela McCauley-Bush about her work utilizing cell phones in disaster response. That's ahead on Intersection. I'm joined in the studio by 90.7's reporter Carmel Dalshad. Carmel, welcome to Intersection.
Thank you.
Well, you went to Egypt in July 2011, and I want to just play a little bit of sound from a video clip that you shot while you were over there. So, Carmel, tell me what's happening in this scene.
Well, this video was taken the beginning of July 2011, and the protesters were in downtown Cairo, kind of by Tahrir Square, and they're upset about the long time it was taking to hand over power from Mubarak, who was ousted, and currently at that time it was with the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces. So what you're hearing people say is, you know, down with the military rule and down with Field Marshal Tantawi, and you're actually going to hear those chants throughout the course of the revolution. They just kind of change the names depending on who's in power and who they don't want in power.
So this was already some months after Mubarak had been ousted from his position?
Yes. So he was ousted in February, and this was in the beginning of July. And a week after that, there was a big protest in July in Tahrir Square, a big sit-in that actually started around the time of Ramadan. And people were wondering, well, would it be dispersed? Would people just go home? And they set up tents to block the sun and the heat. And they were there for quite some time until the army went in and cleaned them out.
So from your point of view, were you already seeing some signs of dissatisfaction building quite soon after the Mubarak had been toppled and people were talking about a new dawn for Egypt?
I think people were really hopeful at that time. And I know it's kind of cliche to say this and almost bad journalism to talk about cab drivers, but the cab drivers that I encountered were just like, hey, what do you think of our revolution? It was pretty great. And there were still people in Tahrir selling T-shirts that said Jan 25 Revolution. And, you know, they kind of made it almost like a tourism spectacle, given that tourism was kind of low since the revolution. So I think people were excited, but they were kind of wondering what was going to happen next because there was no real timeline of when the handover of power was going to be, when is there going to be a presidential election, who the candidates were going to be. It was just kind of like a big question for them. And after witnessing protests that shut down bridges and created lots of crime, people just wanted to go back to daily life, normal life. And I think people were starting to get a little bit annoyed at that point in time.
So how did you end up in Egypt? What took you to Cairo?
Well, so my mother is Egyptian. And even before the revolution happened, I was kind of interested in seeing what was going on in Egypt from an internet standpoint. I had applied for a Fulbright, but I was denied because I wanted to study, hey, what do people do when they go online in Egypt? Mm-hmm. A few months later, the revolution happened. So it was kind of interesting timing to see that. I was studying my master's in journalism, and we had to do a mandatory summer internship overseas if you were doing the international track. So I ended up in Cairo in 2011 in the summer because I had an internship there.
It's interesting, though, you mentioned online. I mean, that was seemed like it was quite an integral part of what was happening in Egypt at the time. There was Twitter activism going on, all kinds of things like that. So when you were there, did you get to see some of that up close and firsthand?
Definitely. I mean, I think that the most interesting thing that you see when you are in the middle of a protest is everybody has a phone out and they're either, you know, taking pictures for their own personal use or they're putting it online on Twitter, on Facebook. Probably there's more Facebook activity in Egypt than Twitter. It seems to be like Twitter is more people that are of a higher class or they can speak more than one language. So, you know, they can reach more people. And there are certainly the Twitter activists that are on the covers of, you know, Time and other news outlets that gained fame from the revolution. But then there's everyday people that are just like, you know, hey, I went to protest today and here's my pictures. Mm-hmm. I think that it echoed kind of what was going on in the streets. And don't forget that the government shut off the internet at some point, you know, to try to get people to not organize, and the protests still happened. So it wasn't only because of the internet or only because of Twitter or Facebook. It helped it along, but that activism was already there on the street.
Mm-hmm. Now, you did some work with citizen journalists when you were in Egypt. Tell me a little bit about that project.
So there were two separate projects. The first one was 18 Days in Egypt, and that kind of came out of what are people doing with their footage and their pictures and their video and their audio from these protests? And if they lose their cell phone or if they change phones, what happens to that content? Because, you know, they're the only person seeing it from that point of view. Did they witness something really important, or did they catch something that maybe we in the media did not see? So it was a project co-started by Jigar Mehta and Yasmin Aliyat, and they built a platform. It was multimedia based, so there was like slides for text, there was embeddable YouTube videos, and you actually connected it to your social media handles. So you connect it to your Twitter, your Facebook, your Google+. And if you want to go back to January 25th, 2011, it will take you back to that day and what you posted on Facebook or on Twitter. And you can embed it into almost like a slideshow. Mm-hmm. So that project, we had five young citizen journalists, and some of them were photojournalists actually, working. And what we had them do was kind of spread out in the community. It was concentrated more on Cairo in the beginning just because of resources. And they went around to people and just interviewed them and said, what did you see? Can you share some of your photos with us? And they made almost like a collaboration online. And that worked out pretty well. But the issue was that not everybody's online to do that stuff. Some people don't have personal computers. And that's why we had the reporters go out and do it. But it wasn't sustainable for the reasons that, you know, not everybody goes online to do that stuff regularly. And some people were really kind of getting weary of media in general. So here we are, young people. Some of us look not like we were not Egyptian. And people were like, why are you interviewing me? And who's this going to? And where is this going to be?
Do you think that having a project like this helps people look back on a situation like what happened in Egypt in January 2011 and make sure they've got the facts straight? Because it seems to me that when you have massive social upheaval like this, there are going to be multiple different narratives. The further out you get from it in terms of time, people are going to reflect back on it differently. If you have a new regime in power, they're going to superimpose their impression of what happened on it. But having this projects like this and just the access to social media, people tweeting from the scene of these protests and gatherings, does that help kind of make sure that history isn't skewed in the aftermath?
There were a number of projects that focused on things like that exactly. Like there's a project called Mosreen, and this group rented out equipment to people to go, you know, take photos and videos, and they just came back and the only agreement was, hey, just give us some of your footage. And I think that came out of a need for people to not rely solely on state media. I talked to one cafe owner who literally like was sharing a wall with state media TV, and he was saying, well, I'm watching the TV, and they're like, oh, Tahrir is quiet today, and there's nothing going on, and they're airing footage of Tahrir during Ramadan the year before when nobody goes out because people are fasting. And he said, I can just walk down the street and see actually there are thousands of people on the street. So there was that growing distrust between, you know, the information that was fed to people by the state media and what was actually going on. But there's on the other hand, there's people that just believe everything that they're getting from state media. And a lot of it is state media propaganda. Mm-hmm. So there really is nothing there to challenge that because the government is doing such a good job of curtailing independent media.
Now, you went back to Egypt again in the fall of 2012. This was after Mohamed Morsi was elected president in June. Mohamed Morsi, of course, of the Muslim Brotherhood in June of 2012. Had the mood changed? Were taxi drivers you talked about before, were they telling you different things now?
I think at that point, people, on one hand, were relieved that there was somebody in power. But the Muslim Brotherhood had been vilified so well by the Hosni Mubarak regime, and they did have a violent past. that people were not sure what was going to happen. Like, hey, if there's a Muslim Brotherhood president in power, are we going to have car bombings going off in the middle of Cairo? And that's something that doesn't historically happen in Egypt. And now it seems to have kind of picked up. Mm-hmm. And they had to operate on an underground basis for so long. People were worried that they would just become power hungry because of that. I know there were a lot of moderate people wondering, man, we're just not that religious. Are we going to have to be forced into wearing, all of us have to wear hijabs or, you know, wear more traditional clothes? Even the people I spoke with that wore hijab, they're like, do we have to go another step further and wear the niqab where our faces are covered? And, you know, Egypt historically was one of the Arab nations that was kind of, you know, modern. In the 60s, people wore miniskirts. And you saw it kind of go backwards a little bit with, you know, issues of sexual harassment and stuff. But they weren't sure what would happen at that point with Morsi in power.
Mm-hmm. What about now? Would you say that press freedom has changed a lot since the January 25th revolution and since the intervening Morsi regime, which was toppled, of course, again by the military?
There was a lot of hope that when there is a democratically elected president, there would be an easement on the press corps, specifically the Arabic versions, not so much the Americanized, you know, media outlets that have the backing of something a little bit more powerful. But journalists were arrested all the time. Stringers for AP and et cetera. Reuters were arrested all the time. Some of them are still in jail right now. So things are bad for the press right now, mm-hmm. if not worse. I mean, if you look at the Press Freedom Index, Egypt is constantly in the bottom part of that. And it's kind of a chilling effect in some cases because when you have people like the three Al Jazeera journalists that are now sentenced to 7 to 10 years in prison, and they're coming from, you know, backgrounds that are Australian and Canadian, what's going to happen to the average Egyptian person who works as a journalist? They don't mm-hmm. have the backing of an organization to go fight for them or to sue on their behalf. They don't have the money or the resources.
It seemed like a lot of people were quite shocked by those sentences, how long they were. Family members of those three journalists were quoted as saying, "We didn't expect this to happen." What about your reaction? Were you surprised?
I was honestly surprised because a few days before that, Abdullah Shami, who was an Al Jazeera Arabic reporter, he was released from prison after 10 months of being in prison. And he was released on, I believe, medical grounds because he went on a hunger strike. But it seemed almost like this shining ray of hope for these three journalists that really, they were arrested for doing nothing but their job. They were arrested in their hotel room, you know, and the Marriott, which used to be a palace for one of the kings, was where a lot of journalists stay, you know. A lot of passing journalists that I know stay there. So it's not uncommon to see people walking around with their equipment. After the downfall of Mohamed Morsi, it became apparent that anybody related to Al Jazeera, whether it's America, English, or Arabic, would be vilified. And that's exactly what's happening. I was surprised because, you know, Secretary of State John Kerry was there, you know, right before then. And there seemed to be a little bit of discussion about should we release them or not. And I was surprised.
Do you think the government in Egypt now is just trying to make an example? Do you think there's still hope for these three that they can be released before they serve out their sentences?
I'm not sure how that's going to go. I know that there's an appeals process, but Egypt is not necessarily known for its great judicial system. And if somebody wants something to go one way, it will go that way. I think that if there's more pressure put on the government from America and maybe even from Qatar, who funds Al Jazeera, maybe. But again, it's that whole idea of the mouthpiece of the Muslim Brotherhood, we don't want them here, mm-hmm. that could hinder them, even though Al Jazeera English is very fair and balanced, you know, but that just that name is what really gets people enraged about them being there. They shut off their offices completely, mm-hmm. And they banned them from entering. And these are award-winning journalists, you know, that have covered stories around the world. And really, there was no evidence presented in the prosecution case. A lot of people believe the trial was a sham.
This week, it'll be 3 years from when you were in Cairo filming the footage that we heard a little clip of earlier on. Now, I'm wondering, just reflecting back on those 3 years, are you surprised things have turned around so radically?
I think the thing about Egypt is that you never really know what direction it's going to go in. So when I first started covering about the revolution, it was in Little Egypt in Astoria, Queens, in New York. And people there were so hopeful. Obviously, these are people that live outside of Egypt. But it was this like awesome thing that, hey, we're still in touch with our home and we're going to be able to keep in touch with protests here, because they did stage protests in front of the embassy. I don't think anybody really thought that the Muslim Brotherhood would shoot to power that fast, or that the protests would continue for so long. But I think that people are almost having almost like a protest fatigue. Mm-hmm. People on the ground seem to want just a normal life now. You know, I've heard people say, oh, man, I just wish that Mubarak was still in power. At least we wouldn't have traffic anymore. So I think that they are suffering from protest fatigue and they just kind of want some sort of stability. And historically speaking, that's always happened with the military because they own a lot of corporations and, you know, they kind of rule with an iron fist. And now they've put in place last year an anti-protest law where if you want to protest, you have to get a permit. So imagine like, oh, you know, we want to have this gathering against you. So let's go to the court and get a permit for that. Chances are you're going to get denied. And this is something that was, you know, happening both under Morsi and Mubarak, where if there was a protest, there would be police officers ratio like 20 to 1 to squash that protest because they were mm-hmm. so afraid of something happening. And lo and behold, the revolution happened in 2011.
Do you think Egyptians who are still interested in reform, who don't have that protest fatigue, will find a way to keep pushing for it? I mean, I'm wondering, you talk about citizen journalism being quite important in the first phases of the so-called Arab Spring. And from what you observe, people, you know, really relying on social media a lot in some cases to get the word out, aside from the mainstream channels of journalism. I'm wondering if, you know, with this maybe a chill on reporting with the jailing of these three journalists, are we going to see that kind of journalism being pushed underground again?
I'm not sure that it's going to be pushed underground. I think people will be a lot more careful. When I was there, I wasn't working as a full-time journalist per se, but I didn't have a press pass. And had I been arrested without a press pass, I would have been in trouble. And that's something I warned my students about. I told them, you guys are students, so just use that, because you are not working journalists. And if you get in jail, I mean, we were a small team. How can we help them? And I was really afraid for them. So there probably is more of a chilling effect on citizen journalists that are locally based.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the larger organizations, I mean, most of them are credited there with the journalist syndicate. And I don't think that they're going to stop reporting on it. I actually think that it's probably going to be a little bit more aggressive, given the fact that it's just becoming a very apparent thing that the government wants to silence dissent in whatever way possible, even if that means silencing the media.
Do you think they're going to make things easier for journalists, for regular people, for protesters in the future if things stabilize a little bit?
No, I don't think that's going to happen. Just because of precedent. It has never happened before. And even if they relinquish some of that power on paper, on the ground, it's completely different. I mean, that protest law that was put in 2013, you know, not only do people have to go get a permit to protest, the police can stop any protest or any gathering that they see. And the government's leaving that to the discretion of the police. And police brutality is not uncommon there. If you look at videos, there are gruesome videos from the revolution of what the police were doing to protesters. I don't foresee them ever giving power. There's a lot of people that think this whole thing was orchestrated, you know, by the military to get people to love the military again. And there is a big military fever in Egypt. People that I'm surprised at, actually, you know, that were more on the, I don't want to say modern side, but pro-revolution, I think they're just getting a little bit tired. And there are people that were diehard revolutionaries that just don't go out to protest anymore. So it's hard to say what's going to happen, but I don't think that the military is ever going to give back any kind of power in that sense.
What about expat Egyptians? You talk about protest fatigue in Egypt itself, but what about here? What are people saying here about what's happening in Egypt?
I think people are very careful of what they do, especially if they have family overseas. And that's something that happens too in like with Syrian protests. They don't want anything to reverberate overseas with people, like their family members. So there are still protests and there's a handful, but it's not like it was in 2011. I mean, there was this feeling of, you know, people are on to something when they're protesting in front of the embassy or the consulate. Whereas now it's not as feverish as it was before.
Mm-hmm. I've been speaking to 90.7 journalist Carmel Delshad. We've been talking about reflections on 3 years after the Arab Spring and what's happening now with press freedom in Egypt and Cairo specifically. Carmel, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, I revisit a conversation with University of Central Florida Professor Pamela McCauley-Bush about her work utilizing cell phones in disaster response. I'm joined in the studio by Dr. Pamela McCauley-Bush. Dr. Bush is an Associate Professor of Industrial Engineering and Management Systems at the University of Central Florida. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much, Matthew. My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So, Dr. Bush, I wanted to start by talking about your recent Fulbright-funded work in New Zealand. Now, you visited the country recently as an expert in residence, I understand, at the Joint Centre for Disaster Research. And that research is focused on information technology and disaster relief, looking specifically at response to earthquakes like the Christchurch earthquake in February 2011, where 185 people died. And that was, you know, one of the biggest natural disasters in New Zealand, so a pretty major event. Just tell me a little bit about the project and what your involvement in it has been so far.
Sure, I'd be glad to. I actually traveled to New Zealand and spent 2 weeks there working with Dr. David Johnston. He's executive director for the Joint Center for Disaster Research at Massey University. So what we're focused on, a couple of things. One is really looking at how mobile technology can be utilized to more effectively prepare and respond to natural and man-made disasters. And term, I guess I want to use as a natural fit to start to look at that because mobile technology is so pervasive. I mean, it's all around us. So the first responders are using it extensively. However, as a researcher, I've asked the question, the mobile technology that we're using, at what point in the disaster management continuum should certain technologies be used? And then, of course, to what degree should they be used? And are we getting the most out of them? So our team is really looking at that, and we've actually developed some mathematical models to quantify what types of mobile technologies might be useful at certain points, primarily for emergency managers.
Just thinking about the Christchurch earthquake, February 2011, there were stories about people being able to text from within the rubble, send messages like that. I mean, do you sort of look at ways of using that to sort of pinpoint people's location, that kind of thing?
Well, that's actually not a component of the research that we look at, although it is tangentially related. Because what we have done, we looked at the first responders' use of mobile technology as well as the general population. And one of the things that we're recognizing is that the general population, because mobile technology is so pervasive and they actually can send pictures and videos and text. So they are a part of the disaster management process. So the emergency management community, even as high up as administration at FEMA, has said we need to understand how we engage the general population in the whole disaster management process, because you're absolutely right, Matt. There were people texting in New Zealand as well as in Haiti after the terrible earthquake in Haiti. So mm-hmm. You've got people texting. You've got the individuals or the citizens in the community sending pictures, trying to let people know what's going on. So it is wise for the emergency management community to understand not only how can they more effectively use the technology, but how can they engage the citizen community so that they're a part of the process as well. So it's a complex issue. It really is. And so really trying to, first of all, understand what are the major challenges. Okay. And then, of course, we like to quantify things or measure them. So then ultimately, our team actually develops mathematical models to measure these different types of impact.
You talk about some of the challenges people face in disasters like the earthquake in Christchurch or the one in Haiti and other natural disasters you might be looking at. There must be a massive sort of inflow of information. And if you add the general public to that as well, how do you manage that information? Because that must be one of the challenges.
It is a huge problem, the influx of information. And I actually have a researcher that's in my lab, Dr. Fuxiang Shi, who is a visiting associate professor from China, who's working with me looking specifically at that and looking at data fusion in high consequence disaster management, because you have so much data. And now we're talking about adding even more, looking at the citizens and how they're putting information out there, because there's only so much information that the decision maker can process. Okay. So how do we get the best information to them as quickly as possible so they can make the decisions and then move on to the next decision? So that's a huge issue.
sometimes in a disaster where infrastructure gets knocked out, say, for example, an earthquake, that can sort of stress a system like a cell phone network. How do you sort of go through all that tangle of different challenges there and find a way to make this technology useful?
When you do have a major disaster and you do start to have communication compromised, our county, state, and federal agencies have a very well-coordinated effort that allows them to a large degree, continue with very solid communication, and particularly with satellite communication and so forth. From a formal standpoint, the communication process is fairly well defined, and they have pretty good resources in place such that it allows them to continue the communication. Now, that's not always the case in smaller countries, and that's why it's been so valuable for us. We also had a collaboration, ongoing collaboration with the Bahamas because of the massive number of hurricanes that they have. So that's not always the case in smaller nations or and particularly island nations because their infrastructure is so vulnerable to begin with. So what we are looking at is, okay, yes, obviously the U.S., we have our vulnerabilities. Clearly we do, even mm-hmm. in many times in our rural areas and sometimes even in the urban area because of the huge populations or additional categories of risk you have to deal with. So there are resources in place, there are processes in place. Technology is supporting many of these processes, and what we are constantly doing is looking at how we can get better at doing that and really answer without just throwing technology at it, but really doing the research to understand what the technology is supporting, how it's reducing a risk, how it's improving preparation. And so those are the kind of big questions. They're just big research problems that we need to look at.
Now, of course, Florida is not an earthquake risk area, but there are other natural hazards that
most certainly.
We have to contend with, like,
my goodness,
hurricanes, tornadoes,
that's correct.
Floods perhaps, and maybe even brush fires if it's a dry summer. So some of the things you're looking at, they're also applicable to here in Florida, right?
Absolutely. Well, the reason that we started the collaboration is because the research we did was focused on hurricanes here. And of course, we're very concerned about the Southeast. But if you are establishing processes that are good for responding in hurricanes, then there should be some applicability across other disasters. I mean, in order to prepare, and clearly there are other things. The ground may be at risk with an earthquake, whereas obviously with a hurricane, you have other issues that are at risk. But your methodology should have, if they're robust, should have some degree of transferability to other types of disasters. And that's why the technology research that we're doing is so important, really understanding at what point do we need to use these different technologies to support the first responders and the decision makers. And then, of course, that should have applicability across other disasters.
It's interesting, too, when you look at the way the general public, I mean, just regular people react to disasters too, because I know that in the aftermath of Sandy, for example, one of the first things they would think about was finding a power outlet for their smartphone or their iPad or what have you. So it seems that technology has become much more central to the way people respond to disasters now.
It really has. And if you think that's a challenge, okay, so we've got the technology, you've got your individual handheld, now we've got social media. So you've got the Facebook and Twitter. And so while all of these things can be very valuable, it's important for us to understand how to most effectively engage them to support the overall process, which is to provide a quick, efficient, and safe response for people. And quite honestly, we want to use as few resources as possible, because if I can limit the resources I use in one community, then that makes me have more resources available to the next community from a people resource, from an energy standpoint. So all of this, all of these make studying disaster management and the human factors aspects of it very exciting.
I've been speaking with Dr. Pamela McCauley-Bush. Dr. Bush is an Associate Professor of Industrial Engineering and Management Systems at the University of Central Florida. Thank you very much for coming in.
You're most welcome. My pleasure. Thank you for having me, Matthew.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is Assistant Producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.